Yes. I had said that I felt obliged, as we're in Berlin, to begin by saying willkommen, welcome, bienvenue. But I am not able to then break into a song from Cabaret. I'm Dennis Altman. I'm chairing this session. All you really need to know about me is I'm a writer. I'm also one of the patrons of the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives, which gives me a special reason to be at this conference. I'm very excited about being on a panel with four people who do not come from the English-speaking world. And I think it's actually a really interesting moment for those of us who do to reflect on the way in which we take for granted that people can come to international conferences and speak in our language without us having to make the equivalent effort to speak in theirs. And it is, of course, an extraordinary event to be sitting on a platform with people from four very diverse countries, from Colombia, Iceland, Tunisia, and Hungary. I'm not going to read out the biographies of our speakers because the program book has done a wonderful job. With the abstracts, you can read a short bio of each of our presenters. So I think all I'm going to do is just call them up one by one in the order we have listed to the stage. I've already warned them that I am known as a fascist chair, and at 10 minutes I'll give you a signal to start winding up. So let's start off. Let me ask Felipe to speak to us.
Thank you very much, and hello, everyone. I will just do a short reading about my theme, and then afterwards, I think we're all going to share some questions and impressions. So I will begin this presentation with a death. On August 23, 1993, the body of Leon Benur Zuleta was found with several staffs near his apartment in Medellin, Colombia. His death was quickly ruled as a passionate crime, bound to his known homosexuality. It was never clarified who murdered him, yet Zuleta was widely known in Colombia as the father of the LGBT movement. Most biographical accounts, which are few and very much with the same information, just copy-paste, only underline his foundational status and his known expulsion of the Colombian Communist Party on account of his sexual orientation. After his death, some public homage was made on his behalf, with some commemorative events and the use of his name in very different but and minor political circles, maybe a plague, maybe some party. Nothing was said about his ideas or his political stances besides his already mentioned founder status, and thus his name faded in something far worse, one could argue, than oblivion, indifference. Around the same time, the newly established constitution in Colombia gave way to the idea of freedom and equality absent in the previous constitution, allowing homosexuals to finally enter the state. The 1991 constitution, who was made after a successful peace talk with one of the several guerrilla groups in Colombia, M19, that gave way to the freedom of development of personality and freedom of speech. And soon enough, with the establishment of the Colombian and FARC peace talks 2002, who were not successful, but nevertheless one of the most important peace talks, the LGBT community was able to completely integrate in the state. Because during these negotiations, for the first time in Colombian history, LGBT people were defined as a social group, bound to its problems and its own relationship with the Colombian Civil War. In this case, sexual diversity was viewed as an homogeneous characteristic of especially vulnerable people, in other words, as victims. In the different stages of the negotiation where LGBT representatives were brought to the free zone and talked with the representative of both the government and the guerrillas, nothing was said about political differences or ideological discussions amongst the newly found and homogeneous LGBT sector. For the government and for most of the delegates, LGBT people were just another powerless victims of the war. Such idea endured over time, and for the most part of the early 21st century, sexual diversity was seen in Colombia as a mere characteristic, devoid of political content. The different reforms of the state in matters of marriage equality or adoption were assumed as a political, technical, if you will, just a case of democratic modernization. That was until recently, with the help of a political group called Colectiva Libertaria Severas Flores and the Queer Archive Institute Colombia Project, we were able to locate new sources about the history of León Zuleta and the Colombian LGBT movement. The first interesting thing that we found was the profound influence that European ideas about sexuality weighed on Zuleta's thought. In a previously unknown interview published in the Colombian New Left magazine Alternativa, Zuleta exposed the various influence for his ideas of a Colombian homosexual liberation movement in 1977. Wilhelm Reich and Guy Hockenheim were both his most influential figures. In fact, according to the research, it was the constant divulgation of Wilhelm Reich, the famous psychologist, anti-Stalinist work, and not his sexual orientation, what created the rift between Zuleta and the Communist Party, from which he actually resigned and was not expelled, according to his personal writings. On the other hand, Hockenheim brings the May 68 movement and the French version of the gay liberation profoundly influenced by the new left to creating a Colombian homosexual liberation movement. In a part of the interview, it can be read, and I will cite here Zuleta. "We fight for sexual liberties, the right to own a body. In front of the homosexual is the possibility to allow free expression, open and unapologetically. For this, there are two roads, a reformist, which allows the reproduction of heterosexual couple relationship, marriage, adoption of children, etc., in the same direction of the Oedipal family, composed of women being passive and men active. The other roads accept the former way as a tactic, but goes further, to the complete sexual decoding, the destruction of the difference between man and woman, child, adult, normal, perverse, dichotomies that give rise to fascism and repression." Close the site. These new documents were accompanied by the rediscovery of papers of the Colombian Homosexual Liberation Movement, three different papers on three different timelines, 1977 to 1979, there you can see the papers, what suggests three different generations between 1977 and 1989 with different political ideas. By studying these papers, I was able to identify at least an active group in five different cities of Colombia, where previously there was thought none. The most prolific were in Bogotá, the capital, and Medellín, from where Zuleta was originally from. A detailed look of those magazines gave us a surprising look on the first stage of the LGBT Colombia movement. For one part, it was extremely leftist. The support of other Latin American groups like Argentina's Frente de Liberación Homosexual made an important impression on the Colombian movement. And on the far side, you can see one of the pictures of the Frente de Liberación Homosexual Argentine, who I found in a little house of one of the activists from the Colombian liberation movement. You can see the aesthetic really bound to the moment of the Latin American history. We're talking about 70s, right? We're talking about a very, very, very convulsive and politically active time. Also, the political situation of the region was closely followed. Che Guevara was celebrated on the papers on the homosexual liberation movement. And the Sandinista revolution of Nicaragua was received with great joy, as it was supposedly LGBT-friendly. Years afterward, we will learn that it was not LGBT-friendly. Actually, it was trying to undermine the LGBT groups that supported the revolution. Of course, the case for the Cuba revolution is very much the same, but this is 1978 and they were still supporting Che Guevara. All of this carried the idea that there could be no real sexual revolution without a social revolution. On another note, the movement was interested in creating community and giving support to that community. Campaigns like the Coca-Cola boycott in support of Florida homosexual movement was a success in several gay establishments in Bogota and Medellin. And here we can see one of the news about the campaign. This campaign was a boycott in support of and against the Disabled Children campaign of Anita Bryan in the late 70s in Florida. Likewise, when the AIDS epidemic broke out in Colombia, the movement was quickly to react by creating a network of information and support, which was a direct response to the inactivity of the Colombian government, who only created a small program at the end of the 80s. Finally, I was able to identify several public manifestations. In Colombia, homosexual behavior was penalized with up to 2 years of prison until 1980. But even before the depenalization, several groups of homosexuals, and I say homosexual because that's the way it was used to refer, including female and males, marched during the 1st of May parades in Cartagena, Bogotá, and Medellín. This idea was in concurrence with the general direction in which several LGBT movements headed by the time. The famous cases of Brazil, where several gay and lesbian organizations supported a metal worker strike that later became the foundation of the Partido de los Trabajadores, in which Lula da Silva was included, and who later includes homosexual liberation as a fundamental part of the party program. And the famous case of the UK and the miners' strike of 84, which is very lovely represented in that movie Pride, with the group Gays, Lesbians and Gays Support the Miners, are testimony of such a tactic. And on the far left side, you can see one picture of those 1st of May marches. Also, we found information of the mythical first Stonewall commemoration parade, made on July 28, 1982. In Bogota. This mythical event was nothing but a rumor in the Colombian LGBT mainstream movement, and sometimes it wasn't even counted on the Pride parade number in the capital city. Yet in the 1982 march, yet the 1982 march was a spectacular march full of colorful signs and eager activists, conscious of the pioneer action. And you can see the picture of the first concentration. People were going out dressed in full bright colors. The pink triangle was a very used logo symbol in that parade. More interestingly still, I found a picture of the same Leon Zuleta marching during the parade, escorted by a gigantic group of policemen. According to the oral testimonies, interviews made after the discovery of those pictures, about 30 people marched that day, accompanied by about 100 armored policemen. And you can see the line of policemen going all over to the far end of the picture. This was a disproportionate response to the local government, fearful of the novelty of such manifestation in a very conservative and, at that moment, religious country. And you can see here Leon marching with a lesbian woman in Spanish. It is said, we are learning to love each other. Viva or live the love without a penis. The lingering question that I had after doing my research was, why was all of this forgotten? Why nobody talked about it? Why there was no commemoration or remembrance of the fur parade or all these diverse groups, the different publications? Now I think that the erasing of this particularly political charge part of the LGBT history was a survival move for fear of war, especially the cleansing squad who emerged in the late 90s in Colombia, responsible for the death of many homosexual activists, created a fear of association to this leftist side of the LGBT movement. The same squad we thought were the ones who killed Leon Zuleta. They were emerged in the country in the late 90s with the rising of drug dealing and the paramilitary forces in Colombia. Amidst the civil war and fearful for their life, most activists resorted to depoliticize the movement in order to change the vision of sexuality, strongly linked to the left, with a more neoliberal approach. The end of ideology makes sexuality ideological. Thus, sexuality became an issue of morality and modernization, leaving behind the ideas of social revolution, intersectionality, and anti-fascism that once gave it birth to. And so I will end this presentation with another death. Sergio Rego Reyes was a young high school student, an enthusiastic anarchist, who took his own life by jumping from one of the most crowded malls of Bogota on August 4, 2014. His death was caused by a relentless persecution from school and medical authorities that viewed his sexual orientation as something he needed to change in order to succeed in life. He was 15 years old. Being of a middle-class family, Sergio felt cornered by the absolute conviction of such institutions and their views on homosexuality. Yet with his death came one final act of protest, one that didn't pass inadvertently. Sergio's death was a consequence of the depoliticization of the LGBT movement in Colombia. The idea of a mechanical reformation of the state had made us blind to the underlying problems that lie beneath the political discussion. The school and the medical institution that harassed Sergio thought of homosexuality as a disease, and so to erase it from his life and thus the rest of the Colombian society. All of this happened after the Constitutional Court had declared the right of equal marriage in Colombia. So why a gay kid took his own life in a country who had already legalized gay marriage? Because such reformation came without a social movement. There was no societal change, no disruption of the status quo. Some privileged activists demanded the state and the state gave away, but there was no inclusion of the broad public in the matter. Such sentence came with no change from below. Reformation, although encouraged, cannot erase homophobia alone. That's why political stance of sexuality is important. That's why it's important to know the previous history of the more radical stage of the LGBT Colombia movement and others abroad. Histories like that one of Zuleta can teach us much about the way society deals with alternative sexuality. An idea like those published on the different gay liberation papers can give us tools to encourage deeper reflection on what it means sexual diversity, not only by learning from the past, but also by interacting with it, asking questions, rebuffing ideas, complementing thoughts. It is possible to plan ahead for a struggle that, as we can see in the news today, it is no over. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Felipe. And now I'll ask Esther's already at the podium. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, and it's very nice to see all of you here. Thank you for coming. I'm here to present and introduce a project that I have been involved in for 2 years now, along with my two colleagues in Iceland. It is called Hidden Women, Women and Queer Sexualities in Icelandic Sources, 1700 to 1960. And this is an archive project, started in 2017. It is supervised by myself and my two colleagues, Iris Ellenberger, who sits here in the second row, and Hafdís Erla Hafsteinsdóttir. It is a grassroots project. We are all in some way or another, one way or another, connected to the University of Iceland. We do some teaching there, but this project is not based inside or within the university in any way. We do this in collaboration with the National Queer Organization of Iceland and the Women's History Archives, and we received generous funding from the Icelandic Equality Fund and also some other smaller funds. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the background behind this project. First of all, I'd like to mention that Iceland is a very small country. We only have a population of approximately 340,000-350,000 people. And that has benefits and also some downsides, some pros and cons. One of the downsides, I guess, is that gay and queer history is an under-researched field in Iceland and a very, very new field. And until very recently, few academics had shown interest in queer history or queer studies in general, actually. In 2017, me and my colleagues mentioned before, my two colleagues, we published the first peer-reviewed book on queer history in Iceland, and in that process we noticed that women were almost completely absent in it. We realized, for example, or in other words, we realized that the queer history scholarship that was coming about and we were participating in was highly occupied with gay men, but much less with women and queerness on a broader scale. There are probably many reasons for this bias. Women in general are receive less attention in history books, and women's and gender history is also a relatively new academic field in Iceland. Another reason has to do with the source material. Sources that have proven fruitful for scholars in other Western countries are largely silent about queer sexualities in the Icelandic case, especially about women before the 1970s and 80s. And these sources include court documents, literature, memoirs, and personal archives. But this does not mean, however, that there are no sources. But we realized that if queer women were to become a part of Icelandic queer history, we had to react deliberately and look for them, even if it meant that we had to search in unusual places and use different approaches. And this is how the Hidden Women project came about. The aims of the project are to systematically search for sources on women's queer sexualities before the gay liberation movement and identity politics, approximately around 1960. And secondly, to make these sources available for other scholars, students, and the public on our website. And we also want to demonstrate how the sources can be used and what they can tell us. And the website, which is the end product of this project, at least this phase of it, will be open formally this year. You can see the link there. It's only in Icelandic. So if you are interested, of course, you can have a look at it. There are also some pictures, very nice pictures. But in this short presentation, I don't have time to delve deeply into the findings. You can ask me some questions about that later if we have time. But I'm going to focus mainly on some of the challenges that we have had to face and our attempts to solve them. First of all, the first question is, of course, what are we looking for? We decided early on, even before we started the project, that when we were working, we decided this when we were working on the book already and realized the lack of information on women. We decided that our approach to history was firmly grounded in queer theory and history of sexuality, and this clear theoretical focus helped us defining what we were looking for. We're looking for traces of queer sexualities, which means, in our case, this is our definition and or our decision. What we were looking for is any kind of non-normative love, erotica, sexual desire, biological sex, gender expression, and for example, what we were looking for based on this is romantic friendship, lifelong partners, sexual relationships between women, gender expression and behavior, etc., that was considered unfeminine or masculine or even unnatural. And we also understand the concept woman very broadly. We understand women or woman as a person who was read as a woman or identified as one. We are, in other words, not trying to find women in the past and make them lesbians, as many people think. We are aware of the fact that lesbian identity and modern ideas about sexuality and even gender do not apply to the people that we find or come about in our project. And we try to navigate how the sources reflect upon not just individual histories, but also the societies the women lived in. Ideas about sexuality, sex and gender, norms and rules of conduct, etc. And the question, how can we avoid projecting modern ideas and identities onto the past, has of course been and remains one of our biggest challenges. But the critical queer perspective has been a very good foundation, I think, and we hope that we have managed to avoid the deepest pits, at least, and the most serious mistakes in this regard. So where do we start? How do we start such a project? I mentioned pros and cons of living in a small community. One of the good things actually is that it's very easy to get information because we have a big network of people that we know. So we use the snowball effect. We use the word of mouth. We talk to colleagues, researchers, archive personnel, librarians, other queer people, especially older queer people. And we were looking for basically anything, any clues, stories, facts, rumors, gossip, whatever they could possibly think of. We also put up a webpage with a submission form where people could submit information to us. And we also try to be present and visible at queer events, for example, and also in the media. We try to spread the word that we were doing this project so that more people would know about it and possibly send us information. This went pretty well, I think. We followed then the clues and started looking based on these clues. Sometimes we found something, sometimes we didn't find anything. We looked in the usual places that you all know probably, archives, manuscript collections, registers, published books, etc. So this was, I guess, when we got the clues and started looking for them, kind of like a basic archive or historical project or research. But then the website, and that's a whole different story. The second phase of the project, how we are going to make the sources available to other scholars and the public on a website. Then we faced a whole range of different challenges. First of all, we had to think about ethical issues and how we could process personal data. How can we break the silence on queer women and queer sexualities without crossing ethical boundaries? How can we be respectful without tolerating queer phobia? This is an urgent question that we need to keep asking ourselves, and I don't have any answer to this question. We decided to use only unpublished personal sources that were written before 1939, and this is a legal issue, has to do with Icelandic legislation. So no personal sources that have not been published previously and were written after 1939 are a part of our project. But the most interesting questions, maybe, are these. How do we present the sources and the findings? How do we structure the website? How can we avoid a modern gay reading of the sources, or the lesbian question, for example? How can we avoid the readers assuming that this website contains a list of lesbians in the past? How can we make the queer approach comprehensible? And this has been very challenging, but also very fun to deal with, I think. So just to close and finish off, I'm going to talk a little bit about the website. This is the front page. Huldukonur is Hidden Women. That's what the name of the project. The structure, the main parts of the website structure are the green boxes at the top of the page, themes and periods. There is no list of names on this website, and you cannot actually search on this website or read this website by starting with names. You can search for names if you have a certain name in mind, but if you go there looking for information, themes and periods are the things that you start reading. And these are the themes and entries that are on the website. The reason why we decided to structure the website on theme, based on themes, is that when we started collecting the sources and reading them, we noticed certain themes. Some of these themes were or could be predicted, but others were quite unexpected. And we found them very interesting. So we decided that instead of building the website on individual women and names, we decided to build it on these themes. And the themes are the ones to the left with the orange color. Behavior, sex and gender, sex life, words, space, class, friendship and silence. And then the black words or phrases are the name of the entries on the website. So to take for example, I could of course talk about this for 40-50 minutes probably, our findings that is, but I'm just going to stop very briefly with the theme space. There are four entries under categorized under the theme space. Abroad, which is about women who went abroad, came back to Iceland or not. The women's movement in the early 20th century, that's a very important space where queer sexualities were present and we can identify them, we can see them. And there's actually quite a lot of material on them. And this has never been discussed, ever. The arts. Women who were artists and went studying art, for example, and women at sea. Women at sea, then we are in the 18th and 19th centuries. This is the entry about women at sea. You see here on the left translations of the main part of the website. The title is Women at Sea. Under the title, there are the periods and themes, 18th and 19th centuries, and Rime is the name for space in Icelandic. The orange box is a brief introduction. Then below is the main content of the website, or of the entry, general information about the sources, a list of sources, and then last but not least, the green box, or the box in the middle, is interpretation and context. And this is very important, we think, because there we give examples and demonstrate how the sources can be interpreted from a queer perspective and in a queer context. So this is how we guide the readers into a queer interpretation without necessarily telling them that this is the truth and the only truth. This is just a way of interpreting the sources in question. I am stopping right now. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm now going to ask Rami to go and talk about Tunisia.
Okay. Hi everyone. So I will be talking about the situation of the LGBTIQ community in Tunisia. I guess that most of you already heard about Tunisia because the country was making the international headlines for the last few years as the sole unique and last remaining hope of the Arab Spring. Especially after the promulgation of a constitution that it was widely hailed as the most progressive one in the Arab region. However, what we should not forget is that Tunisia is still applying an arsenal of laws that clearly contravene this new constitution and the international obligations of the country, including an article of the penal code called Article 230, the Tunisian sodomy law. What the article actually says is, I will try to translate, the initial version is a French version, which says that sodomy is punishable to up to 3 years in prison, and the Arabic version, which is the authoritative version, replaces the word sodomy by liwatan musahaka in Arabic, which can be translated into male or female homosexuality. But while Tunisian conservatives are in defending this article are often invoking the protection of Tunisian and Islamic values against the Western influence, some commentators in Tunisia recently tried to focus on the law's colonial origins for two main reasons. The first reason is that Article 230 first appeared in the Tunisian legal system in the 1913 Penal Code, which was promulgated under the French protectorate. The second argument is that the previous iteration of of the Tunisian Penal Code, the Criminal Code of 1861, when Tunisia was an independent state, didn't have any mention of homosexuality or sodomy whatsoever. But there is a small problem with this hypothesis, because as you might know, France was one of the first countries in the world to decriminalize homosexuality right after the French Revolution in 1791. And the 1810 French Penal Code, which was the basis for the Tunisian Penal Code, didn't have any sodomy laws. And if we want even to go back earlier than the French Revolution to the Ancien Régime, to the old regime in France, sodomy was punishable by burning at the stake, so nothing to do with the 3 years in prison that we have in the Tunisian Penal Code. So two main historical research questions arise. The first one is why a sodomy law and where does it come from? And the second one is why did the drafters settle on 3 years in prison as the appropriate sentence? Some brief historical elements for those who don't know. Tunisia was under French protectorate from 1881 to 1956. A protectorate is a middle ground between an independent state and a colony, where the two states would operate under a very theoretical system of co-sovereignty, which was the case for Tunisia. Before the protectorate, Tunisia was marked by what we call the legal pluralism, where Tunisian Muslims, Tunisian Jews, Italian communities, French communities, British communities who were living in Tunisia for a long time were judged in different courts according to very different laws. And this was seen by the French authorities as a threat to their control over the country. So very quickly after the French colonization or protectorate, they moved to get rid of this legal pluralism by launching a big process of codification of the Tunisian law. All the laws, so the criminal, the civil, and the commercial laws. And in 1909, the commission who was tasked to draft the penal code was appointed. The first draft that was published of the work of this commission that we found in the archives. Let me talk about the composition of this penal commission first. As you can see in this document coming from the National Archives, this commission was made of 8 members, 6 of whom were French and 2 were Tunisians. I would just give the names of two main members, the two French members, Bernard Roy, who was the head of the commission, Henri Guyot, the rapporteur of the commission. The two other names are the names of two Tunisian Islamic legal scholars who were part of the commission, who probably didn't participate that much in the drafting of the law, but they were put in the commission just to give an impression that we included the Tunisians in it. And they came from two different Islamic jurisprudences, the Hanafi and the Maliki jurisprudences. The first draft of the penal code appeared in 1911, and here you can see the front page of this preliminary draft. And what we can read, and because I'm citing this because it would be very interesting to know later to understand the criminalization process, is that the code was based mainly on the French penal code of 1810, the Code Napoleon, and obviously the Islamic law, but also it borrowed significantly from the Ottoman, the Egyptian, and the Thai penal code. Now remember the Thai penal code because it will be very interesting later. We tried to look into the 434 articles of this code, and big deception, none of them had any mention of homosexuality or sodomy in the draft. So we got this idea to start looking in the margins, because we found out that in the margins there were some handwritten notes. And we said that maybe we can find some interesting information in the margins, although it is very hard to believe. But we found that the first appearance of Article 230 was actually as a handwritten note in the margins of the morality crimes section. So it was added at the very last minute before sending the document to the Résident Général, to the French authority, and it was a handwritten note in the margins, not even typed as all the other articles. Now this makes our task very difficult to understand why this law is included, because unlike other articles, because in each article, typed articles, we put here one of the other articles, in the other articles you have footnotes under each article explaining the legal system or the legal influences that from where the article was borrowed. So here is the public indecency article, and you see that it was borrowed from the French, the Hungarian, the Ottoman, and the Egyptian penal codes. But unlike other articles, remember that Article 230 was a handwritten note, so it didn't have any footnotes under the article, and so we cannot be 100% sure of its legal influences. So we tried to look if there are any meeting notes or legislative history of the work of the Penal Commission, and we found out that there is no such document in the National Archives or even in the French Archives. But many legal scholars and historians told us about one particular and very interesting document, which is called a commentary of the Penal Code that you can see in the picture. And this commentary was drafted by Henri Guyot. Henri Guyot, who was the rapporteur of the commission, 1 year after the promulgation of the Tunisian Penal Code. We were very happy to find this document, but unfortunately, in the preface of the document, they talk about the existence of two books. Only the first book is still available on the National Archives. The second book, covering the morality crimes section, is missing, or maybe it was never published. So again, we cannot be 100% sure about the legal origins and influences behind Article 230. Thus, we had to put several hypotheses and to work on them. Now, I won't have enough time to explain all the hypotheses. I can share with you the whole document later on by email. I have the electronic version, but I will go through the most likely explanations about the sodomy law. I would like to say that none of these explanations are mutually exclusive. They are all interconnected and overlapping. I will start by the idea of the criminalization of homosexuality. What we think is it comes actually from the Sharia requirements, the Islamic law itself. Because if you look into the footnotes of the 1911 preliminary draft that we were talking about, one Islamic legal source appears in most of the articles. This legal source is called the Handbook of the Maliki Jurisprudence, or the Handbook of Sidi Khalil, which is a 14th century text that was translated into almost all the European languages and considered by all the European powers as the most important document to understand the Sharia and the Islamic law. And if we look into section 43 of this handbook, it is very clear that homosexuality was criminalized. It says pederasty or sodomy is the equivalent of illicit cohabitation and incurs the legal penalty of stoning. So it gives us an idea about the idea itself of criminalization, but unfortunately nothing about the 3 years in prison. Here comes the idea of the legal pluralism that I was talking about in the beginning. Because if the Maliki jurisprudence, one of the Islamic schools, theoretically mandates death, even though it makes its application almost impossible, the Hanafi jurisprudence is more flexible and allows for discretionary punishment for homosexuality. And this is what the members of the commission did, because they relied on the Hanafi madhab, the jurisprudence, to escape the stoning punishment. We have this very known Tunisian expression saying "Ittaka al Hanafi," which means rely on the Hanafi law, which refers to trickery and transgression of religious norms by which one can escape the punishment by relying or pretending to rely on the Hanafi madhab instead of the Maliki jurisprudence. So they escaped the stoning. We tried to look why 3 years in prison.
Rami, I'm going to have to start winding you up.
Oh, I have 1 minute or not?
Yes, you have 1 minute. And after that, a trapdoor opens and you fall from the stage.
Okay, I would like to say that the 3 years in prison come from the Thai penal code. It's very weird because Thailand was not even, it's thousands of miles away, it's not a French colony. But what we found out is that the Thai penal code was written actually by the French diplomat called Georges Padoue, who before going to Thailand was serving in Tunisia. And you know what? He was even the adjoint, the deputy of Bernard Roy, the head of the Penal Code Commission. The last slide, and I will stop there, is that the other arguments maybe that led to the criminalization is the perception of Arab sexuality in the French colonial imaginary. Because even if it was decriminalized in metropolitan France, it was not in the colonies. So because there was this fear of the sexual chaos, and there was this racist theories about the impact of the sultry African heat on the sexual drive of both men and women in the French theories. And I will wrap up by saying that the differences between the theories I've been explaining should not obscure an important historical truth. Article 230 appeared during the French protectorate, within a penal code drafted almost exclusively by French colonial officials, while the commission members may have seen themselves as respecting Tunisian customs or properly interpreting Sharia laws, the fact remains that a small group of French bureaucrats criminalized homosexuality in Tunisia. Thank you.
I have to say, Rami, it's not much fun being a fascist chair, but sometimes it's necessary. And I'm delighted to ask Judith, as our last speaker, to come to the stage.
Can I have some? Sorry, it's just a bit watery everywhere, so. Sorry, there's some more coming. May I have some? It's a bit, Sorry. All right. So, good afternoon, everyone. I will focus in this presentation on decriminalization of homosexuality in Hungary in the light of recently discovered archive records. And though Rami already mentioned some Hungarian connections with the penal code of Tunisia, but in this presentation I won't continue that thread, but I will open a new one about this decriminalization. And I would like to tell you just very briefly about the context of this finding, which happened in the course of a social history research, which we started in 2013 and completed in 2017. I mean, we completed the data gathering, and now we are in the process of disseminating our results, and this is one of our dissemination events, I guess. So for the sake of completeness, before I focus on decriminalization, I would like to tell you very shortly about the actual criminalization process in Hungary, which was, well, for a long time a part of the Habsburg Empire. Though we had our Hungarian the home affairs were not very much affected by the Austrians, at least this is how Hungarians like to see this. So until 1878 we didn't really have any sodomy laws, not by the state, and then less than 100 years, we had actually homosexual acts between adult men criminalized. And in Hungarian, it was called Természet elleni fajtalanság büntette, which means perversion against nature or unnatural fornication. And this was a largely undefined term. And we didn't really have a legal distinction between homosexual relationships and pedophile cases. And this is what we saw when we went through all these unnatural fornication cases, which survived in, for example, in the Budapest archives or the Hungarian National Archives. And we can see that in 1961, which we call the decriminalization of homosexuality in Hungary, it wasn't the end of the process, of course, because at that time there was the age of consent for heterosexual and homosexual relations defined in a different way. The age of consent for homosexual relations was 20, and the age of consent for heterosexual relations was 14. And in 1978, they lowered the age of consent for same-sex relationships for 18, and it happened only in 2002, before Hungary actually joined the European Union, that they equalized the age of consent to 14. So this is now we have the age of 14, and it's the same age of consent. But we want to go back now very quickly to some of our findings. So, as I mentioned, we have done a lot of archive work, and in one of our focus, we focused partly on these court cases, which I won't share with you today. I just want to raise your attention that we found a lot of very interesting cases from the 1950s, but of course, I already listened to one of the German colleagues who did some research on the Stasi archive findings. These are very specific findings, because of course these reflect only the perspective of those who did the observations, who conducted the court cases. So this is a very skewed perception of these, of reality. And when we want to reconstruct homosexual life of the 1950s, we have to be very careful, because if we just rely on these findings, we will represent only one side of the coin, I would say. So, what I would like to focus on now is really about the legalization of same-sex sexual acts between consenting adults, and this happened in Hungary in 1961. Well, actually, the actual penal code, the new state socialist penal code, came into effect in 1961. And for contextualization, have a look at the other state socialist countries. What happened there? It's very interesting to see, for example, the Soviet Union, which wasn't the Soviet Union in 1922 yet, but Soviet Russia had this decriminalization period already between 1922. In fact, in the first draft of the Bolshevik penal code, it was already there in 1917, 1918, but we know for sure that we had this kind of early Russian sexual revolution from the 1920s, and it was really, I guess, a great period, but we tend to forget about this. And then we had, because of the Stalinist era, we focus mainly on that, and this was also very much affecting other state socialist countries like Hungary. And of course, we have to mention that later in 1993, homosexual acts became decriminalized in Russia. And then obviously homosexual propaganda law. Recriminalized again or so what is very interesting is, for example, Poland can be quite an interesting case, because if we look at present day Poland, we wouldn't imagine that this was the first state socialist country where they actually decriminalized homosexuality. Of course, we have to take into consideration that in Poland, in Polish territories, you will see that sometimes the Russian, Prussian, Austrian, whatever legislation took over. But Poland itself, I would be proud as if I were Polish that they had this legislation. Now, on the other hand, we have Czechoslovakia and Hungary, which decriminalized homosexuality in the same year. Actually, in Czechoslovakia, they introduced it already in 1961. In Hungary, it came into effect only in 62. And then the other countries, Bulgaria, East Germany in 68, certain parts of Yugoslavia and only in the 70s, and then in the Baltic states, which are very close to Soviet Union, and only in the early 90s, and for example, Romania was one of the last ones, at the end of the 20th century in decriminalization. So therefore, it's quite interesting to see why it happened in 1961 in Hungary. We were always asking this question, why in 61? And we cannot really answer this question very precisely, but at least during our social history archive research, what we did, we started to look through all the documents of the Ministry of Health in Hungary, and we did a lot of search, hundreds of big boxes full of very dusty documents, and in one of these boxes we have found these were three interesting documents. And one of them was the minutes of the Egészségügyi Tudományos Tanács, which is the Health Science Council. They had a so-called neurology committee, which included a lot of psychiatrists. And they had a meeting in 1951 March. And here, Antal Csorba, who was actually a military doctor, gave a presentation on the medical and criminal problems of homosexuality. And then the third document was an official report summarizing the expert opinion of the committee. And this was a report which had to be passed on to the party, the Communist Party, who actually made the final big decisions in everything, I guess. I would like to very quickly just give you a few examples. What were the arguments in this report? And it's quite interesting that there are 10 main points what they raise, and this is presented in a kind of interesting way, that they state something as you can see here, like prosecution of biological phenomena by law is not logical. But so present the kind of opposing view. But punishment is necessary to keep the purity of sex life protected. And then they kind of summarize it. At the same time, the purity of society's sex life will not be damaged if homosexual acts are not penalized. A healthy society with heterosexual preferences has a natural aversion against this disorder. It doesn't appear necessary to to have a separate penalty. Homosexuality leads to revulsion, disgust, and does not tempt imitation. And if there is no publicity, there is no question about social threat. So this was one of the points. So it's interesting, you see, first they, you know, state something, then they oppose it, and then they, you know, okay, at the same time, So I will present you two more. Okay, the offense cannot...
You only have two more minutes.
You see, the offense cannot be proved objectively, but it is punishable because it can corrupt the youth by diverting their sexual development in an abnormal direction. Very familiar arguments, I guess. At the same time, in the context of heterosexual relations, protection of the youth is covered by other articles of the criminal law, which can be supplemented with regard to homosexuality. And then the third one, the offense that has no victim doesn't pose any danger either to individual rights or to the interest of society. There is no social harm if conducted by adults consensually and not publicly, but it can ruin family life. At the same time, penalization cannot guarantee protection of family life. Inborn homosexuals are unable to lead a regular heterosexual family life. This heterosexual family life can be observed in the cases of bisexuality. In this context, penalizing extramarital sexual relations would not be logical, since extramarital heterosexual relations are not considered a criminal offense either. And actually, I don't have time for that, but there are two more quite interesting out of the 10. One of them is about, again, you know, quite familiar arguments about, population growth. You know, if everyone is gay, we have this problem. But then they say, why? You know, at the same time, they say, the interest of protecting population growth cannot justify penalization because, in this case, contraception should be penalized as well. So, on this note, I have to say that I think this is quite not just entertaining, but actually quite interesting elements are raised here. For example, also homosexual marriage is already raised as an issue and discussed by these psychiatrists. So this shows shift to the medicalization of the issue from the sin paradigm. It's a medical issue, and you can see, which I won't have time to read it, the official reasoning which became part of the ministerial presentation of the bill of decriminalizing homosexual acts between consenting adults in Hungary in 1961 in the parliament. So thank you very much for your attention.
I suspect we all share frustration that in all cases we wanted much more, and I had the horrible job of being the traffic cop. But I had to be the traffic cop to allow you in the audience the opportunity to ask questions. And I think that the way we could do it is because we had four such rich and not necessarily overlapping papers, you could either direct questions specifically at one of the four panelists, or you could ask a generic question. It's a bit difficult to see, but can I see if anyone is ready to ask a question? Yes, we've got a question down here. Good, the light's coming up, yes. Let's take three questions, and then we'll let the people on the stage respond. So, and can I just say, I'm an Australian, and in Australia, a question is a sentence with a question mark. It is not a long statement that... is why you ought to be on the platform rather than the four panelists.
Rami, I have a question for you. And it's regarding the rather remarkable reforms that Bourguiba made in the Tunisian Penal Code and why homosexuality was not among them, especially given the fact that women's rights were so famously subject to liberalization.
Thank you. You take a note of that. And there was, there's one up there, I can see. Ah, There's one here. Can you see with the mic? There's one here and one behind.
I have a question too. May I?
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Okay, I thought we had a mic on both sides. No.
We have. Okay. So my question is for Asta from the Hindu, because on your theme slide you had this silence, and I was really interested in what's that about.
Wonderful. Then up the back there, and then we'll. Yep.
Hi, my question is for Rami. My question is, did you try to get access to the archives of the Al-Zaytuna Mosque? Because we know all of the discussions between the religious imams happened there. So because through your presentation, I got the point that the article about number 230 got its origin from the French authorities, while I believe it's beyond that, like reading through all the history of Tunisia, most of the laws, even the royal family was very proactive in making them. And the proof, for example, you said that Hanafid law has the big influence. We know that only the royal family, it was Hanafid. 99% of Tunisia is Maliki. And this is proof that it's not only French authority product, but it's also from Tunisia. And I think this was to please the French authority, like we had the Ahd al-Aman, the first constitution, it was to please the French authorities after killing a Jewish citizen in Tunisia.
Okay, look, let's let Rami and Asta answer those questions, and then we'll take another round.
Why homosexuality was not decriminalized by the Bourguiba regime? Bourguiba was the first president of Tunisia. I think that I really like Bourguiba myself, but I mean, the whole Bourguiban regime was a heteropatriarchal regime, as any in the region. They made a lot of reforms in terms of women's rights, but still centered on the idea of the pater familias in Latin, so the idea of the father of who is the head of the family. So they didn't touch it even, and any idea that could threaten this whole patriarchal system was not even touched. So some reforms here and there, but without touching the whole patriarchal system. The Zaytuna Mosque, no, unfortunately, because it's the biggest mosque in Tunisia, because it is not very easy to access, first, and second, because I didn't have the time to explain everything, but the penal code was written by the French officials, actually. So even the two Tunisian members who were there, they didn't have any role, because all the discussions took place in French, and they didn't even speak French. The first draft was in French, and they didn't even speak French, so they were not even able to make any comments. So it was, at the end, a French enterprise, at the end, trying to take some legal aspects from the Islamic school, but it was a French enterprise.
Asta?
Thank you. This was an excellent question about the silences. We saw when we started looking at the sources that we found that there were some obvious silences in these sources, that a lot of sources that weren't there, quite obviously. And this is always the case when you look at something, of course. So there's always something that is not there and you don't know why exactly. But because our approach was very much centered on trying to understand how the sources reflected on the society they were written in, or and the people who lived in those times, we also decided that it was necessary to address these silences, to actually try to understand them a little bit. Why do we not have sources on this particular woman or this particular theme or whatever it is? So we decided to, instead of just continuing the silence, we decided to address it. And we identified two different kinds of silences. Those are the two entries about silence. One of them is sources that are not there about a particular group of women or a certain period or something like that. And then secondly, sources that have obviously been deleted, like something that should be in the box in the archives, but it's not.
It'd be really good now if we had questions for Felipe or Judith. Yes, I can see now. I can see a number of hands. Okay, so I'm going to take there, there, and there, I think. So.
Thank you so much to all presenters for such thrilling presentations. My question is for Felipe. If you could just comment on the reception of, and forgive me for mispronouncing his name, Häkkänen's, Guy Häkkänen's work that you mentioned, especially in the context of translation and language. Were they reading it in the original French? What was exactly taking place there? Thank you.
Okay, and then there's, you're doing all the running around. There's a hand here. And then Russell, yes, go here first.
That's very lucky because my question was for Judith. But first, thank you for four wonderful presentations that were really engaging and interesting. Judith, I was interested in that meeting you say had profound importance through a report. It's very interesting because something similar happened in Denmark in 1930s. But were there any footnotes? Because and what I mean is, are they referring in the report to specific psychiatrists, doctors, jurists? Who is the ideological inspiration behind what you call pragmatic thinking around homosexuality? Yes, that's my question.
Okay.
Hi, I'm going to be boring and thank everyone again because it's been fantastic, all four papers. My question's for Felipe. You've described a situation where, on the one hand, the state is, you know, legalizing, you know, things like gay marriage or whatever. But on the other hand, there's been an obliteration of history and also a situation which is still effectively dangerous for many people. What's the future of this kind of information and research inside Colombia?
Okay, this is wonderful. Felipe, you get to respond to the two questions, then we'll go to Judith.
Yeah, thank you for the questions. The first about Hockenheim, I'm really not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly. I get the same. The thing is, when we did this research, we presented in a LGBT community center in downtown Bogota. And when we did the presentation, it was really unfortunate because when I showed the same photos, this guy raised her hand and said, "That is me on the far side of that picture." And I was like, "Oh, really?" And he started to connect me with different other members of the group. And that's how I knew that none of them speak any French. And the first translation of Revolution and Sex, which is the seminal work of Hockenheim, to Spanish was only made until the 19th. So he explained to me that the thing they did was they got a French edition and they all gathered around and circled with a French dictionary and started to translate word by word the best looking passages when they were words that they could understand, like Marxism or revolution. So those passages, they translated. And that's how they started to get the work done. So they didn't really read full Hockenheim until much later. And that's the thing that's the thing about oral archives or oral memories, that they are not in these archives, and they're always important. And the other thing about the information is actually really difficult because most of these papers, most of these photos, they were not in an archive, they were not in a library, they were spread out all through Colombia. Some guy had a photo, some other guy had a picture, some other guy had one number, two numbers of the papers. So it's really, really, really difficult to gather all this information. We are trying right now with a couple of universities to try to concentrate this information, but it's actually really, really difficult because there is no conscious of the value of this information. And it's actually really interesting to be here and learning that there is a lot of archive process in a lot of places. And I'm just thinking, like, I got this little box in my room with all this thing, and I can't do anything. The only thing we have done is scan all these things because of the fear that maybe somewhere it will deteriorate it and we will lose it. So it is a problem, but because this conscious of preserving LGBT history is not there. It's not in Colombian LGBT movement because of the uncomfortable idea that these movements were linked to the left. Colombia is still in the Cold War. It hasn't ended in Colombia yet, the Cold War. And this strong link to the left of this movement is uncomfortable for the mainstream LGBT movement. So that's why it's not interesting to anyone. So we're looking for, like, next year we're trying to launch a website, like in Blogspot, because we don't have for anything else, and put the PDF there, and we'll try to do our best we can with that. Thanks.
I'll hand this to Judith. I should just say to the four panelists that then we'll take one quick round of questions and then let everybody on the stage have a final summary, because there are clearly some overlapping themes that are now coming through.
Thank you for the question. Today I didn't... focus on these psychiatric aspects, but one of the main references which this military doctor referred to was Alfred Binet and Conrad Lorenz, and mainly imprinting. This is very much emphasized the biological nature of homosexuality, of course, and what was quite interesting that they made quite a lengthy reference to the Turner syndrome. That is, if you are not familiar with this, it's where external feminine genitalia are possible with a male chromosome set without the person psychosexually identifying as a man. This person identifies as a woman, and as she was raised, this psychosexuality does not seem to be dependent on the sex chromosome. So, for example, this is a direct quote from this presentation. And what was quite interesting, that of course not just medical references were made, though neurologists were these people who discussed the issue, but also legal references, especially to the German legislation. And they refer to Hitler as, the Hitlerian German prosecution of homosexuality was a big no-no. So we should decriminalize homosexuality because, of course, we are good communists. But they failed to mention the Soviet legislation of 1920s. But at that time, when, in 1958, it was very much prosecuted homosexuality, but they failed to mention that. So they referred to the 1920s Soviet legislation and the Hitler era. So this was very much biased, I would say, but it in a kind of, if I may say that, positive bias for decriminalizing. So they distorted the facts, let's put it this way. And of course, we can argue that, these hereditary references, that's also a kind of distortion, because some of these psychiatrists were quite enlightened ones, but I guess they applied their wisdom in a special way.
Look, we are running out of time. We can take one quick question, because I do want to give people on the stage a final word. Is there any urgent question? You get the last question. I was hoping we'd have a woman, actually, but you will pretend you're a woman for these purposes.
Well, Christine, and for all, how to influence legislation that silence files and histories? Because in Mexico, we have a new law of... archives, and it's a law that silences LGBT history.
Thank you. And I think everyone might want to speak to that. I need to just make one housekeeping announcement before everybody leaves, which is for the walking tours tomorrow. Anyone signed up has to present themselves at the information desk 45 minutes ahead, which for Trudy's tour means meet at 12:15, and for Finn's tour meet at 14:45, or as we would say, 2:45 p.m. I'm going to make one comment and then ask all of you to final words. And I think I just wanted us to not forget the point that Felipe made, both in his presentation and then again in answering the questions, and that is those complex historical links between homosexual movements and the left. And this, I think, runs through, perhaps not in the case of Iceland. I mean, had you more time, you might well have touched on that anyway. But certainly it struck me with the other three presentations that those connections between homosexual emancipation, to use an old-fashioned term, and left-wing political movements, thinking very broadly, are actually a very important part of the story that needs to be unpacked, and I think relates also to the last question. But let me now ask all the panel, maybe we'll do it in reverse order to the way in which you spoke. So we'll start with Judith and move across.
Well, in Hungary, in the if I want to refer, you know, to your to the point you raised about the left and homosexual decriminalization. I mean, this didn't really happen in the 1950s, which was a kind of leftish terror, at least in Hungary. This was the Stalinistic era, which didn't really help the queer culture to flourish, if we can put it this way. Only after the Stalinistic era was over in the late 50s, but I think we would be more safe to say in the from the 1960s or onward, something could happen. So I'm quite sure that, you know, any kind of totalitarian approach doesn't help us to live the lives we would like to live. So and I would say that the left has a lot of shades as well, and not all of them are preferring queer cultures. So I would also like to refer to the question very briefly, what was asked by our Mexican colleague about accessibility of archives, which is a very important thing. Or actually, it's a more broad issue about accessibility of data, because not all data are in archives, and we have to recognize that, you know, where the data is, that these are data. For example, in the case of oral archives or oral histories, and in the case of official archives, it can be a lot of hassle to get access to these files, not just in this case of Stasi or KGB or Securitate, or in Hungary our secret police archives, but the fact that we have to present ourselves as a, you know, serious researcher, and then fill out several questionnaires, and then even then we get a lot of data we hold back. So we have to be very creative most of the time, I would say, and we need a lot of time, of course, and patience, because, you know, like all these dusty boxes, I remember when we dealt with the 150s and we still didn't have anything, but we just went on and, you know, try to get some air, because the air is getting very dirty. That's not so easy. Well, anyway.
maybe the idea that I want to emphasize is this idea of the interactions between the Eastern and Western worlds, and especially Europe and the Middle East, and how it influenced in different times the processes of criminalization of or decriminalization of homosexuality. I mentioned in the beginning of my presentation the 1861 Tunisian Penal Code, which didn't have any sodomy laws, and this was coming from the French influence after the French Revolution, a big wave of the decriminalization that touched the Ottoman Empire, and they came through until Tunisia. But then how this interaction was in the other side, and how the interaction with the French colonial authorities led to the recriminalization of homosexuality. And this is maybe something very interesting to think about and to see how all these waves of criminalization and decriminalization in the whole Euro-Mediterranean region, because we are in a way connected.
Thank you. Just to respond to the question, I think the archives are always full of silences, and this is something that we always have to deal with. And we haven't in our project had to deal with any law except the law that the new legislation that is protecting personal data or processing of personal data. That's a whole different thing and kind of complicated and vague. We don't actually know what it means still. But looking in the archives, you can easily say, when you're looking for queer sexuality, so women, for example, you can easily say that they're just full of silences. You can easily say that there's nothing there, but that's not true. You just have to look a little bit differently and look for other things, because these things are not categorized as queer or as, you know, even not under women's names. You have to look in different, and not even in the archives, you have to look elsewhere. So, that was that. But just quickly, because you've been talking about decriminalization, and I haven't even mentioned it, but the decriminalization of homosexuality in Iceland happened in 1940, and there was no discussion of it in the parliament or anyway. It was just a translation of the Danish Penal Code from 1930, because Iceland was a part of Denmark. And it seems that the Icelandic politicians didn't even talk about it. They just accepted this translation of the Danish code and then took it up. This code meant that for the first time women's homosexuality was taken into or acknowledged formally. Before that, it was not a part of the code. So even if it was decriminalized, the women's sexuality was for the first time there, because the age of consent was, of course, different, like in many other legislations. And this is also the period where we stop finding as much personal information about queer women's sexuality as before. So this shows that there was some kind of increase of awareness of women's homosexuality at the time, and at the same time it could become more difficult to find these personal sources.
I would like to end with this idea that we tend to see these archives and these histories as something already established. And one thing that it has happened in Latin America, because is of course there are problems from both sides. I mean, I show you that in Colombia they like the homosexual movement, like Che Guevara, but we all know what happened on Cuba. We have read Arenas. We know what happened to homosexual people on the island after the revolution. So it's not about the left or the right. It's about the political conscience. Why? And this is not from Colombia, it's a Latin American tendency. Why didn't Latin America, the homosexual movement, look to the left? Because they were the only ones who were talking about liberation in that part of the world at that time, with all their contradiction and all you want, but they were the ones who were talking about liberation. So that teaches that sexuality, and in this case, this archive, these memoirs, are political. And I would like to end with that. A change of government, a change of administration can erase a whole history of a population. That is what is happening in Latin America. We saw last week what happened in Brazil. What was pride in Brazil last week? But a scream of refusing to be erased by a new government who was openly homophobic. So I think what we could learn about all this discussion on archive and on history, they are political. They must be political. We must not forget that this is something worth fighting for. And thanks.
say you've done my job for me. I don't think we need to do anything else. Thank you all for being such a wonderful audience. Thank you to the panel. And can I just share my frustration? In all cases, I wanted more and I had to cut you off. So thank you all very much.